Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you all for coming, and welcome to the University of Minnesota Bookstores. Before we get started, I'd like to invite you to our website, where you can access this reading and a lot of our other author readings. It takes about a week for them to get posted. It's at www.bookstore.umn.edu. Our guest today, as you know, is Charles Baxter. He was born in Minneapolis and attended McAllister College. He then went on and got his PhD in English at the State University of New York at Buffalo. He then taught for several years at Wayne State University in Detroit. In 1989, he moved to the Department of English at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, and its MFA program. He's currently the Edelstein Keller Professor of Creative Writing at the University of Minnesota. He is the author of 8 previous works of fiction, including Saul and Patsy, The Feast of Love, which was a finalist for the National Book Award and was made into a movie, as you probably all know, Through the Safety Net, First Light, Shadow Play, and Believers, among others. He's published several books of essays on fiction, including Burning Down the House and Beyond Plot, and most recently he's co-edited a wonderful book on the author William Maxwell. His work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Harper's, and other journals and magazines. He has received the Award of Merit in the Short Story and the Award in Literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, the Prix Saint-Valentin in France, and the Catalan Booksellers Association Award for Book of the Year in Spain. He's here today to read from his latest novel, The Soul Thief, published in February by Random House. We're very pleased to have him with us today. Please join me in welcoming Charles Baxter.
Thank you, Terry, and thank you all for coming. It looks as if some of you were assigned to come here. I just have this suspicion that maybe you were required to come here. And if you were, thanks anyway. This is about the last reading I'm going to be giving from this book on what has been a sort of book tour. And what I'd like to do is just talk a bit to you about how this novel came to be. Often it's very hard to describe to audiences where these plots and stories that you use come from, but not this one. This one is not that hard to talk about. When I came in this afternoon, Terry said to me, well, I read your book last night and the character in it, there's a character named Jerome Kuhlberg. She said, he really is creepy. Wasn't that the adjective you used? She couldn't stand him. And I said more or less, you should have met him in person. So here's the deal. About 30 years ago, I was a young writer, and I was trying to get my footing in the world of publishing and literature, and I had nobody to read my stuff. So what I started to do was to send my work, the work that hadn't been published, to a friend of mine who in those days lived in Los Angeles, although I had first met him in Buffalo, New York, where I had been a graduate student. And I knew this was risky. And the reason I knew it was risky was that when I knew him in Buffalo, I knew him to be something of a sociopath, which means that he was a pathological liar. He was a brilliant guy, just brilliant. He would say these things to you, and you would go home thinking about it. One time I told him, he asked me what kind of writing I wanted to do, and I said, well, I want to write revolutionary work. And he said, in his sepulchral way, I don't want to write revolutionary work. I want to write rotational work, work that's like a revolving door, work that spins on a pivot. I thought, man, that's brilliant. I've never heard anybody say anything like that before. And I went home and I thought, what does he mean? What is he talking about? What's rotational writing? I have no idea. What it is a thought disorder, and that's what he had. Anyway, he was so smart, I thought, I will send him my work. And I sent him my work week after week, month after month, for about 2 years. And he would call up. My wife Martha is here and remembers these calls that he made to me on weekends. And he would talk for an hour or two. And he was giving me this incredible feedback about my work. These were unpublished novels, unpublished stories. And I thought, this guy, I don't care if he's a liar. He's the best reader in the world, the most brilliant reader I'm ever going to have. So this went on for about 2 years, and then he asked me for some poems, which he said a guy he knew was going to put into an anthology. So I sent these poems, and they appeared in this anthology. I never had anything to do with the editor, so I wrote to the editor, and when I told my friend that I had done that, he said, "Charlie." I said, "What?" "I have a terrible thing to tell you." I said, "What's that, Michael?" And he said, "I've been telling everyone out here that I am Charles Baxter." And I said, "But that's preposterous." And he said, "But it's true. Do you think I should go into therapy?" And I said, "I don't know, but I do know that you're going to have to tell everybody that you're not me." He said, "That's going to be very hard." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, I've been giving readings." And I found out that he had been going around Los Angeles with my manuscripts, giving readings as Charles Baxter, and that, you know, "Tonight, Charles Baxter." And this guy would show up, and he would read some of my stuff, and what he was claiming was that Charles Baxter was his pen name, that he couldn't write under his own name. He had to write under a sort of dull, you know, Midwestern name like Charles Baxter. And so for years after that, I would meet people who had been associated with this literary scene in Los Angeles, and they would meet me and they'd say, "Oh, you're him." And I'd say, "What do you mean you're him?" And, "Oh, you're the guy that that guy said he was." Said, "Yeah, I'm me. What are you talking about?" So, this thing happened to me about 30 years ago, and this guy is now a very prominent figure on the radio and in the literary scene. And I won't tell you who he is. In all of these readings, I've been careful not to mention his name, but lots and lots of authors know who he is. So for 30 years, I sat on top of this story, and about 4 years ago, a friend of mine, I didn't know how to write about it because it's so strange. If something happens to you in your life that's so strange that most people have never had an experience like that, it's almost impossible to use it in fiction. Not quite, but almost impossible, because people need a kind of entryway into the story you're telling. But about 4 or 5 years ago, a friend of mine told me the story of how, when she was a freshman at Duke University, her roommate began to steal her clothes and to wear them. And then she began to pick up her gestures and began to pick up her verbal mannerisms. I think there was a movie called Single White Female in which some of this stuff happened. Anyway, I thought, that's interesting. You know, when you're in your late adolescence, you start modeling yourself on people, and then you do that for a while, and then you stop. But a few people don't stop. They go on imitating other people. They can't stop doing it. So that was sort of the second entryway into this. And the third one was that I started to get really interested I was working on this book 2 or 3 years ago, on the way that identities can be fabricated. in MySpace and on the web, how it is that you can put together a virtual identity for yourself in places like that. And I began to think that identity, the way that we present ourselves to the world, is getting to be a very odd category. So I set to work on a story in which one person tries to steal not only an identity, but in effect a kind of the person's soul. The Buddhists call people like this hungry ghosts. You know, somebody you know who just seems to want to take in an almost vampirish way something out of you. So I'll read you a few paragraphs here and there. I'll read a couple of paragraphs from the opening chapter. The first thing I'll do is read the epigraph, which is from Frank Bidart's wonderful poem, Golden State. I dreamed I had my wish. I seemed to see the conditions of my life upon a luminous stage. How I could change, how I could not, the roots of necessity and choice. He was insufferable, one of those boy geniuses, all nerve and brain. Before I encountered him in person, I heard the stories. They told me that he was aberrant. Abnormal is too ordinary an adjective to apply to him. A whiz kid sage with a wide range of affectations. At the age of 19, during spring break, he took up strolling through Prospect Park with a walking stick and a fedora. Even the pigeons stared at him. Not for him the beaches in Florida, or nudity in its physical form, or the vulgarity of joy. He did not often change clothes, preferring to wear the same shirt until it had become ostentatiously threadbare. He carried around the old-fashioned odor of Bohemia. He was homely. His teachers feared him. He was an adept in both classical and popular cultures. For example, he had argued that after the shower scene in Hitchcock's Psycho, Marion Crane isn't dead, but she isn't not dead either, because the iris in her eyeball is constricted in that gigantic close-up matching the close-up of the shower drain. The irises of the dead are dilated. Hers are not. So in some sense, she's still alive, though the blood is pouring out of her wounds. Here I have to perform a tricky maneuver because I'm implicated in everything that happened. The maneuver's logic may become clear before my story is over. I must turn myself into a he and give myself a bland Anglo-Saxon name. Any one of them will do as long as the name recedes into anonymity. The surname that I will therefore give myself is Mason. An equally inconspicuous given name is also required, and here it is, Nathaniel. So that is who I am, Nathaniel Mason. He himself was Jerome Kuhlberg, a preposterous name, non-fictional, uninvented by him, an old man's name, someone who totters through Prospect Park stabilized with a cane. No one ever called him Jerry. It was always Jerome or Kuhlberg. He insisted on both for visibility and because as names they were as dowdy as a soiled woolen overcoat. All his appearances had an illusionary but powerful electrical charge. But the electricity was static electricity and went nowhere, although it could maim and injure. by illusionary, I mean to say that he was a thief. And what he tried to do was steal souls, including mine. He appeared to have no identity of his own. From this wound, he bled to death like Marion Crane, although for him, death was not fatal. You can tell I've read this passage a lot because I have it all but memorized. That business about Hitchcock's Psycho is true, by the way. After Psycho came out, Alfred Hitchcock was sent many letters by ophthalmologists who told him that he had made a terrible mistake because when Marion Crane is lying there, supposedly dead, in the bathtub, her irises are constricted. So I mean, she has to be alive. And Hitchcock said, oh, it was a terrible mistake. Some of my graduate students are here, and we have been talking in that class about, lately, I've been talking about narrative urgency, the problem of getting into your fiction the sense that something is about to happen and that you have to keep reading. For that reason, my friend Jim Shepherd calls this the sense of imminence. Something is about to happen. And I have a scene I'm going to read just a little bit of, in which the narrator, or the protagonist, Nathaniel Mason, goes with Kuhlberg and a woman named Teresa. They all live in Buffalo, but they're going out to Niagara Falls because Kuhlberg has said that if you go to Niagara Falls at night, the gods will come out. So they think, well, we should do that. So they go out in late afternoon, and they're on Goat Island, which is in the middle of the Niagara River. Just before I wrote this scene, I had to cash in my frequent flyer miles and fly out to Buffalo and Niagara Falls to see if the scene that I planned to write could actually happen in the way I described it as happening. It turns out that it can, but only in the place on Goat Island where I said it was. Something terrible is about to happen. The thought drifts downward over Nathaniel like a veil over a face. The fact of water rushing past in the river, the fact of the rich darkness in this park at night, the fact of the storm clouds and a bit of lightning, the fact of beautiful, anxiously intelligent Teresa sitting next to him who may or may not be his adoring lover, all these facts make him nervous, uneasy. Ease is elsewhere. Ease is for others. When, Nathaniel wonders, will I ever get free of these narratives in which the gods are promised? When will anybody? Nothing's going to happen, he says glumly. Nothing is ever going to happen. Oh, yes, Kuhlberg says, his voice coming out of the dark. Something will. Something will always happen. You just have to wait patiently until it does. And how long is that? Teresa asks. Oh, we can make it happen, Kuhlberg says. History is ours. For example, he rises from the bench and shambles in his raincoat over to where the water laps against Goat Island. Teresa and Nathaniel follow him. Down below, the Niagara River seems to be calm, but under the surface probably isn't. If you fell in that water, there would be no resisting it. All your earthly choices would be over. The gods are in the water, Kuhlberg says. That's why they have the dynamo over there, down below, to capture them. He waits for a minute. People think that the gods are in the air, but they aren't. They're pulsating down below. They're waterborne. Then they're pushed by the generators into high power lines. Okay, I have an idea. What's your idea? Nathaniel asks. I'll stand here, Kuhlberg says, with my back to you and me facing the river. And what you do is you push me. And I'll start to fall into the river. And then, after I've lost my balance, but before I fall, you reach out and you grab me. You pull me back. I don't like your idea, Teresa says. Well, it's a serious idea, and here I am, Kuhlberg tells them, walking a few steps toward the embankment where the Park Service has cleared away the scrub brush for the sake of the view. The distance to the water seems negligible, but it's impossible to tell how deep the river might be at this point. He holds his arms out in a gesture of resignation, a shrug, an imitation of a crucifixion, an homage to the gods he has claimed are located in this spot. In front of them, the river flows past, dividing. Grab onto my coat, he shouts. Nathaniel takes a handful of cloth at mid-level in his right fist and another handful lower in his left. Then he unclutches his hands, letting Kuhlberg go. Okay, Kuhlberg says, Teresa, push me into the river. Teresa looks down at her shoes. Aren't we too old for this? She asks. Aren't we adults by now? Give me a push, he says. There's a moment when everything stops. Nathaniel glances up to see the masses of land in the distance, Grand Island and Navy Island. A late autumn thunderstorm has opened the heavens with cumulonimbus clouds and lightning. As if in slow motion, Teresa gives Kuhlberg a tentative push, and Kuhlberg loses his balance. He appears to tilt forward toward the water and his own death. And at that point, Nathaniel, almost without thinking, lunges toward him. With one hand, he grabs the back of the coat and with his left arm encircles Kuhlberg's waist, pulling him back onto safe ground, while in the distance, cloud lightning briefly illuminates the scene. Thank you, he says. I've been saved. Your turn. He says to Teresa. He turns to Nathaniel. See, something happened. It's like a drug that wakes you up. Nathaniel expects Teresa to balk, but she doesn't. She stands exactly where Kuhlberg stood, though she does not hold her arms out as he had in the crucifixion shrug. Nathaniel cannot see her face clearly, but he can tell that her eyes are closed. Okay, she says, I'm ready. I'll do this. Nathaniel announces, slipping in behind her. With his right arm, he gives her a slight push, but with insufficient force to lose her balance or to fall forward. She does lean over, pantomiming a fall as his arm clutches her just above the hip as a lover would, whereupon she falls backward into him, as if she knew all along that this stunt was a pretext for some good-natured fun. Somehow, both of Nathaniel's arms surround her now as if he were embracing her. No, not as if, because that's actually what he's doing, he realizes as she squirms. She turns around and lifts her face to kiss him, standing on tiptoes, a quick kiss that he returns. Kuhlberg, of course, is watching all this. Would you kiss her again? Kuhlberg asks. I'd like to see that. No, Nathaniel whispers angrily, for Christ's sake. In that case, it's your turn. Reluctantly, in a kind of dream state, Nathaniel releases Teresa to take his place in front of the embankment. Someone has always saved me, he thinks as he closes his eyes. When his father died and his sister lost her words, and his beautiful mother seemed about as unstable as a canoe in white water, his stepfather took over their care and removed the family to New York, to the sunny apartment on West End Avenue, walking distance to the overpraised Zabars. Life settled down long enough for him to grow to be a man and for his mother to regain her steady, calm heart. For an instant, he remembers the rug on the doorway of his stepfather's apartment on the 11th floor of their building, its deep red weave. Through his closed eyelids, he stares at the darkness before him. He listens to the water for a 5-second eternity. Then two hands push at him. He begins to fall forward, and nothing reaches out at his sweater to pull him back. Nothing saves him. I won't leave you there. He's going to be all right. He's going to be all right, but just barely. Near the end of the book, somebody asked me in one of these bookstore readings, aren't you worried about what the model for this person will think? And I first said, you know, I don't care what he thinks. Though my wife today found something on Google that said that he's recommended it. That can't be right. It can't be right. But I, you know, when I was thinking of the way I wanted to put this book together, I wanted for there to be, for me and for him, the sense that this process had somehow, his worries about it and my worries about it had come to an end. So I'm going to read one of the last chapters. It's this long. Some of the chapters in the book are very short, less than a page long. You will say this is a trick. You will say this is the last twist of the knife that eviscerates the patient. But a disagreement is offered. This narrative contained no trick. It comprised the story itself. And didn't the details leave you every possible clue? On every page, the narrative intentions were plain, even obvious, starting with that reference to Psycho and going on from there. He played by the rules. He played fair. But the point cannot be that one person can take on another person's life and in identifying with the other, give life to himself. Such a modest observation. We all know that. The point must lie elsewhere. The point is that although love may die, what is said on its behalf cannot be consumed by the passage of time, and forgiveness is everything. So I'm going to stop my reading there and ask if you have any questions, any sorts of things that you want to ask or whatever it may be. I should say, first of all, thank you all for coming again. Thanks. Thank you. Any questions? You can ask me anything about this book. Believe me, I've answered almost every conceivable question about it by now. So it's impossible to offend me. Yes.
Fall off the cliff reminds me of the Saul and Patsy car accident.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you done that readers in the gap?
I think you always have to play fair with these sorts of scenes. I did learn, the gentleman is referring to a much earlier story of mine, one that I wrote in 1984. It was incorporated into my book, Saul and Patsy, but in its original form, what I did was to write a story about this young couple who go to a party. They're Easterners, but they find themselves in the Midwest. They go to a party, they drink a lot. They have too much to drink, and they get into a car and drive home. And at the very end of the story, the driver, Saul, passes out behind the wheel, and the car goes, the story says, into a follow makes a left turn that wasn't there, and then the car turns over, and one of the rear tail lights begins blinking. And I ended the story there. And readers were furious with me. You can still find the story in my book, Through the Safety Net. People started to call me up. There was a very large woman at a literary convention in Detroit who grabbed my coat by the lapels and started shaking me as if I were a dog, and said, "You have your nerve killing off that nice couple." And I said, "They're not dead." She said, "How do you know?" I said, "Well, I'm the author. I should know." And she said, "Well, prove it." You know, I was saying to my workshop a week or two ago that in a workshop there is a fiction that everybody is going to read your work to the end no matter what. And in workshops they will, because that's the requirement of the workshop. But in the real world, once you guys all leave the university, once you leave English classes in which you're required to finish the books that you've been assigned, nothing requires you to finish a story. Nothing requires you to finish a book unless you're interested in it and unless there seems to be some kind of narrative pressure on the materials that makes them seem to you and to other people important, or this word I've been using, urgent. So, I mean, if you overdo it, it's going to seem melodramatic. It'll seem as if you're cooking up these situations just so that readers will be caught in a almost literal cliffhanger. This is a kind of cliffhanger. So I try to make it as organically part of the story as I can, and not to do it too much. Just, you know, the key is not to overdo it. Any more than Hitchcock did. Yeah, you know. In the thinking of Hitchcock makes me think of Patricia Highsmith, and I don't know if any of you guys know her wonderful novels. She is a terrific American writer who was very interested in these sort of crisscross plots and the sort of plot in which one character takes on the identity of another. Maybe you saw The Talented Mr. Ripley, where Ripley becomes somebody else. She's a great one for sort of high dramatic situations that you think are going to become just shamelessly melodramatic, but they seem to arise out of the situations that she actually has cooked up. I like her work a great deal. There's a little homage to Patricia Highsmith in this book. It's tucked away, but it's there. Yeah, Ethan.
Did you go to L.A. to read for this book?
No, I didn't. I didn't go to L.A. The second half of the book takes place in L.A., and the only reason that publishers ever send you out to L.A. for bookstore readings usually requires a tie-in with an interview by my ex-friend. And because I wasn't very likely to have an interview on the radio with my ex-friend, I didn't go to L.A. I had an interview on the radio this morning, though, from somebody in Irvine who said, who was very nice about the description of L.A. In the book. And I said, well, you know, the best descriptions of settings are always written by people who are strangers to that place. I mean, Los Angeles has never lost its strangeness to me, no matter how many times I go there. It always looks peculiar to me. And that's an ideal situation for a writer. When you're looking at something or some people and you say, why is it like that? Why do people live like this? That's ideal for writers. You know, the strangeness of something makes it new again. And that's the way I always feel in L.A. Maybe one last question, and then, yes.
Do you think authors are ever, I don't know, afraid of going off character because of outrage that could come from the readers, even if it's maybe the ending you would have wanted?
That usually is only a problem if an author has a big following. And I can't be said to have a big following. But Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was besieged by people who were angry that he had killed off Sherlock Holmes in a fight with Dr. Moriarty. They went over the falls, I think. And so he had to bring Sherlock Holmes back. I'm trying to think of whether there's a contemporary example. Can any of you guys think of somebody being killed off by an author and the audience being outraged by it? I can't think of one. Is there a Harry Potter? I don't know the Harry Potter book, so I don't know. Is he killed off? Okay, not Harry. All right. But... you know, these things do happen. Hitchcock always said that the thing that appealed to him about Psycho was that, and the reason in those days, you couldn't get into the movie theater after it started, and you were not supposed to talk to anybody who had actually been in it, was that he killed off the main star 40 minutes into the film. So you went off to this movie starring Janet Leigh, and she gets killed off 40 minutes into it, and you think, that can't happen, but it had. So, you know, these things can be calculated, too. Maybe one more, Patrick, you had.
Yeah, can you just talk about the process of turning this real-life event into fiction? When does it become imaginative and like fiction?
The question is, how do you turn a real-life thing into fiction? You daydream about it for about a year and a half, and you think... I wrote 40 pages of it, about the first 30 or 40 pages, and then I put it aside for several months because I couldn't figure out where it was going to go and what I was going to do with it. And because also what had happened to me, somebody claiming to have written my work, I thought had absolutely no narrative interest. So I thought, I've got to do this thing differently. And so I figured out a way that Kuhlberg would start to claim to have had autobiographical... things had happened to him, he would say, that had actually happened to the Nathaniel. And then there's a certain amount of mayhem that arises in the story. I thought somebody has to suffer for all this. And someone does, and I couldn't decide how much mayhem I needed. I didn't want to write a murder, but I thought the novel was tending toward that. But something almost as bad happens, and I had to sit and decide what I was going to do. I shouldn't say this to workshop people because you usually have only a few weeks to put your stuff together, but for me it's a matter of productive daydreaming. I was always a daydreamer. I still am. Most writers spend a lot of time staring off into space. That's where my best stuff comes from. Thank you again for coming. Thank you.